I personally believe that this is one of the greatest times of the year. And here's why I believe it. First of all, it's supposed to be spring. So I really like spring. Fall is my favorite season. Spring comes in second. But I love the about 60 or 70 warm days. We've had a few. And I'm okay with it dropping even to the 30s or 40s at night. Because you get up in the morning and you can have that crisp air. And it's just like, oh yeah, that is pure air, man. And I love this time of year because of sports. If you're not a sports fan, you can tune me out. But March Madness is going on. Upsets galore. Some teams get lucky, like Michigan. I mean, that's for you, Dan Key. But here's the real reason. Real sports fans. And don't come up to me after church and say, no, this is the real sport. I have the microphone. Spring training of Major League Baseball is in full swing, and opening day is like a week away. It is the best time of year because I love baseball. Now, some of you are like, that's what I nap to. Yeah, it's fine, but I love baseball. And it wasn't always that way, and I think one of the reasons was is because I wasn't very good at baseball, and I was better at basketball, so I just chose the sport I thought I was better at. And then about halfway through, I started playing baseball at my young age, my childhood, and it was like one of them things, if you ask a kid what's your favorite sport, they'll tell you the one that they're in. And then when the season changes, it's that favorite sport. I was there for a while, but once the coach allowed me to start being a catcher, I started kind of developing a love for the game, and the problem was that I loved being a pitcher first. In fact, when I was 12, and this is me bragging on myself, so ignore it if you don't like it, I actually pitched a no-hitter. Now, this is like on a small field, but it was a no-hitter. It counted. I remember that. So I always thought of myself as a pitcher. But it was when I entered into high school that my coach said to me, Jonathan, I think you could be a really good catcher. By my sophomore year, I was starting on the varsity team. Now, some of you are going to think, wow, that's really good. When your baseball team isn't very good, it's not really that big of a deal. Like, our hope some games was that we would get 10-run ruled in 5 innings rather than 6 because we were ready to go home. But the coach had me starting as a catcher by varsity year, or my sophomore year. And I remember the first game. You really have one rule as a catcher. Don't let the ball get behind you. That's it. I mean, anything else, don't let the ball get behind you. 6 times in that first start, I let the ball get behind me. And there was this moment that I had where I was shameful, I was discouraged, because I knew I could do better. And I was determined from that moment on, I took responsibility for my position and decided I'm going to be the best defensive catcher I can be. It doesn't matter the score of the game. It doesn't matter whether the ball seems impossible to try and keep in front of me or not. I will make every effort every time to be the best that I can be. About halfway through that season, my coach called me in the office and he said, Jonathan, you're one of our better pitchers right now. I said, really? Like, I didn't know. He said, yeah, we bring you in with runners on base and they've not scored many times. I'm like, oh, well, that's cool because usually we're down by 5 when I come in. So I don't really focus on it. He said, but I want you to know why I don't pitch you more. I said, okay. He said something that actually would change my life, not because of baseball, but because I learned how to become a pastor on the baseball field. I just didn't know it yet. He said, Jonathan, you're the rock of our defense. What we gain with you pitching, we lose far more by not having you as the catcher behind the plate. Something shifted in my soul that day. Because he told me, you're the captain on the field. You're the coach. I wasn't the captain in the huddles. We had a senior who did that, who would give us advice, sometimes appropriate and sometimes not appropriate, but he would give it anyway. But I began to take it seriously. So all of a sudden, I was no longer just responsible for my own position, but I wanted to make everybody else better at theirs. So I tried to start memorizing batters. I was taught how to do this my freshman year, is you would remember shoelaces or batting gloves or that kid has a lot of acne. And like you remember certain things oh, this guy hit the ball really hard to the third baseman. So you know what you do? Don't throw that pitch again. But you tell your third baseman, you say, hey, move a little towards the line. Or, hey, this guy is really fast. He's not very strong, so he's probably going to hit the ball on the ground. Come forward. Oh, this guy can't hit an outside pitch. If he does, it's going to go to the right side of the infield. So I'd kind of cue my second baseman to move over a little bit. Little did I know that it was a soul shift. It was a shift from taking responsibility primarily for my own position to taking responsibility for the position that others were in. Translation: when God transforms our soul, we begin to follow Him as sheep, and He is our shepherd. But somewhere along the line, He will call every one of us to make a shift. And it's this shift. It's the shift from primarily being responsible for your own spiritual position to taking on the responsibility of someone else's spiritual position. I realize this morning, some of you may not be ready for that shift. That's okay. Because I believe there to be two different stages. As you're learning and as you're growing, you will be in the sheep stage. And we never truly outgrow the sheep stage because He's always our shepherd. But once you get to a certain place, He will call you to do more than take responsibility for your own life. He will call you to take responsibility for the spiritual lives of those people that are around you. What a sacred, holy, high calling that is. Do I need to remind us what's at stake today? The goal of the game is not to get people to fill our seats. The goal of the game is not to get people to even believe in Jesus. The goal in the game is to get people to follow Him and to become like Him. I've noticed that the church, capital C, has become good at a lot of things. But I think we're bad at the one thing that really defines it all. And that's making disciples. And I've been burdened. Because you and I, we have a long list of people who they probably profess faith in Jesus, but there sure aren't any fruits in their life anymore of Jesus being anywhere present. You do realize we'll just pretend it's all the people who are unable to be here today. We'll pick on them since they're not here. You do realize week after week there's people who come into this place believing that they're okay with Jesus. But the truth of the matter is that when He returns or they stand before Him when they breathe their last breath, there will be many who sit in seats or pews week after week to whom He will say, "Away from me, for I never knew you." It occurs to me that the way we combat that is not by getting more sheep. It's helping sheep to become shepherds. Anytime throughout the Old Testament that there has been a spiritual condition, a spiritual crisis, you know what God has called for? He's called for less leaders and He's called for more shepherds. In 2 Kings, the book of Kings is all about a list of kings and whether or not they did right in the eyes of the Lord or did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And more kings than not did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They had a lot of leaders. They had a lot of kings. But you know how he described the spiritual condition when kings were ruling in the Old Testament? He said they were like sheep without a shepherd. The problem was not to get more leaders, and the problem was not that they needed more sheep. It was that they needed sheep to become shepherds. In the book of Ezekiel, when Israel has been warned and warned and warned and warned not to follow the sins of their ancestors, and they do, and they actually were taken into captivity for 70 years, and there was just a remnant left. And by the way, they only left the poor, the impoverished, the disabled. They left the weakest of all clans. You know why all of that happened? God blames it on the shepherds. It were the priests. They were the leaders of the people, and yet it was the people, it were the priests who led them astray. They were like sheep without a shepherd. We know one of the famous miracles throughout Scripture is the feeding of the 5,000. You know why Jesus fed the 5,000? Because after he lost a dear friend, a family member, John the Baptist, he went to a place to retreat and pray, to have his own time of grief. And yet the crowds followed him a few miles around the lake. And when he arrived on the other side, the crowds had beat him. And here's what it said. He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. See, every time there's been a spiritual crisis, every time there's been a lot at stake, every time there's people who will claim the way of life and yet live another, hypocrisy. There will be a religious people who are judgmental, who clean the outside of their bowls but never deal with the dirt and the grime and the sin and the evil inside the bowls. That's called being a Pharisee. Every time that has been running rapid with God's people, the call has been the same throughout Scripture. It's been a call for more shepherds. See, I think people want to be leaders, but they don't want to be shepherds, and here's why. Leaders get power. Come on, none of us ever dreamt of growing up and like being the vice president of the United States of America. We wanted to be the president, right? We didn't dream of being, oh, I'm going to be the secretary for the business owner. Oh, no, we dreamed of running our own business. Why? Because we dreamed of the power and the leader. But shepherds are not about power as much as they are about peace. They're not about the position they have with people as much as they are about the position they have with Jesus. And I want to prove it to you. Luke chapter 15 is where I'm building all of this out of today. I want to read the first two verses to you this morning. Luke chapter 15, there's two kinds of people. Now the tax collectors, one group of people, and sinners, we're all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees, the second group of people, and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Two kinds of people. One that were leaders, one that were sheep who were going to become like shepherds. Let's start first with the leaders. The Pharisees are well known throughout Scripture. They're the ones that Jesus butted heads with the most because they thought that they had it all together. They thought that what they believed and how they lived was enough to save them. And more times than not, Jesus only preached condemnation against the religious people. Translation, against the church-going, Bible-believing, probably Bible-thumping people. But here's how the Pharisees dealt with how they saw people. They were always concerned about the position they had over people. They rated themselves and compared themselves to everyone else who was not like them. Some of you know Christians like this, don't you? I hope they're not sitting next to you. Some people have been hurt by the church because we know Christians. I'll leave that as a loose term like that. But here's what they said. There was an old rabbi rule that the Pharisees followed. Don't even associate with anyone that is less than you, sinners and tax collectors especially, even for the purpose of the law. What were they saying? Don't mess with lost people, even for the purpose of trying to get them saved, because you might become like them. Do you see it? For the Pharisees, it was all about the position they had over people. Here's the tendency in the church. I see two. The first is this. Some people think they're leaders, but there ain't nobody following. Sometimes I want to ask people, you in what army? You see the dilemma. If he's calling for shepherds, that means that you must have sheep. But what happens, the more religious you become, sometimes the more we alienate the people who need us to be shepherds to them the most. So the longer that we've been Christians, people talk about making this grand influence, but I want to know, how many unchurched people are you friends with? Understand, I say this to myself. You understand, it's a whole lot easier for me just to stay with church people all day and never make a contact or have a relationship with someone who's outside of the world. So that's the first problem I see. So what happens is we say, oh, we're leading. You can't lead if people aren't going to follow. The second problem I see with this is what our kids hear when we do this. Is that you have to wait until you have a position over people to be able to shepherd them. So what we think growing up is, once I have a position high enough, then I can make a difference in my world. But shepherding doesn't start with the position we have with people. You know where shepherding starts? The position that we have with Jesus. Do you see it? Pharisees compared themselves to the sinners and tax collectors, saying, we won't associate with them. But did you hear the first verse? You see it? It was the sinners and the tax collectors. They were all gathering around who? Jesus. It wasn't about the position they had over people. Oh no, it was about the position they had with Jesus Himself. If you have a relationship with Jesus Christ, you are a shepherd. Because people will be drawn to you. Actually, they think they're drawn to you. They're actually drawn to the one that you are centered around. You see, I think we're doing a disservice to our kids by telling them they need to wait to have a position. Oh no, right where you're at, right in your grade, right on your team, right in your classroom, you are a shepherd to the kids that are around you. The kids who need love, you know about an unconditional, unfailing love, and you can love them the way the Good Shepherd loves us. Here's my concern. The reason we struggle to have shepherds is because the people that we think are ready to be shepherds are not yet centered around Jesus. You see, it's really hard to take responsibility for someone else's spiritual condition when we don't do a very good job of taking care of our own. Hear me. You know why it's so hard, day after day, week after week, to read our Bible the way we should, to pray the way we should? Because the devil knows that if we have a hard time taking care of ourselves, we can't take care of anyone else. Confession? There are times I go longer than I should without prayer or without reading my Bible. My guess is if we took a poll, we would all be we could all admit that there are times that our life is not always centered on Jesus the way that we should. But here's the difference between shepherds and leaders. Leaders will say, well, I'm still better than them. Shepherds will say, it's not about them, it's about Jesus. Because here's the thing, when people see me, I want them to get to Jesus. I don't want them to get to me. And so long as we are moving and staying centered on Jesus, guess what? There's going to be people who are drawn to us and they're going to start following. And eventually what they're going to see is, wait a minute, he's not following himself, he's following Jesus. And then they're going to say, I don't even need them, I need Jesus. So people are going to say, wow, I thought she just had good morals or good parents or something. It may have been that, but she's following Jesus. It's Jesus that I need. Forget them. So what does this look like? So Jesus tells a parable to help us understand. It's a parable that we don't always like in the church, but I'm glad he told it. He says, suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Notice something. He starts out with the assumption that you and I are a shepherd. You have 100 sheep. You lose one of them. Won't you leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until you find it? And when you find it, you will joyfully put it on your shoulders and go home. Then you will call all your friends and neighbors together and say, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there'll be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who did not need to repent. See, the assumption is that we will become shepherds. Because who he's talking to, he's not talking to the sinners and tax collectors. Because the sinners can't be shepherds if they're not yet sheep. That's true. So he has to be talking about the people who already are leaders and have people who are following them. He was talking to the Pharisees. And by the way, the position of being a shepherd was a position that no one wanted because it was considered to be the lowest and the poorest position of all. You never grew up saying, "What do you want to be someday?" "I want to be a shepherd." No, you didn't. That's like having to be the person that cleans the toilets all the time. Somebody's got to do it, but you don't want to be the one to have to do it. Right? It was that kind of dirty, that kind of unclean. So he's talking to these people to become shepherds. And here's where we struggle sometimes. We don't understand the culture. I've never heard this, but I was doing some study this week. Here's what they did. So the 100 sheep didn't belong to one shepherd. It would have belonged to two or three shepherds. And all of the sheep actually were the sheep of a village. So let's say we are a village. So Megan, you have 2 sheep. Dad, you have 3 sheep. Pete and Tiffany, you have a big family, so you have to have more sheep. So you have 6 sheep, whatever. What you would do is you weren't responsible for your own sheep. We would find 2 or 3 shepherds out of all of the group, and everybody would bring their sheep together. We would make one pen in the middle of our little village, and together we might have 100 sheep. And then we would pick from the people 2 or 3 to be shepherds over them. You didn't hire outsiders, because hired hands, they won't take care of stuff the same way that someone among you, that it belongs to you, takes care of it. So here's what they did. Overnight, they stayed in this pen in the middle of the village. The shepherds, I love this, they go to the gate every morning. Now understand, they've been 12, 15 hours without food. I know how you get when you go 12 or 15 hours without food. You wouldn't hear anything I'm saying. And the shepherd, they would open the gate, there'd be 2 or 3 in line, and they'd start calling the sheep by name. So, Spot, come here. You won't be a good sacrifice, Liam, because it has to be without spot or blemish. But come on, Spot. And Spot would know the voice of the shepherd and would come out. And would call the 3, 4, 5 of his sheep, and they would come out and they would head out of town. The next shepherd would come up, call out his sheep. Now, I can't even train my dog to behave, much less a bunch of hungry sheep. So, watch it. So then they get out in the open country. Somewhere along the route, they realize they've lost one of them. Now, understand, they were valuable. Megan, how many sheep did I give you? 2? So I lost one of your sheep. You still got another one. It's okay. It's only 50%. It's like saying to a parent, "You got 3 kids. You bring them to my house. Hey, I lost one. Sorry, you still got 2. It sounds crazy to us that if we have 100 sheep and we lose one, we kind of laugh, ha ha, right? But if it's our kids, they're valuable. Every one is valuable. They say, "Oh no, we lost someone's sheep. We lost Megan's sheep. She only had 2. It's like losing one of her kids. I'm going to do everything I can to find it." So here's what you do. Here's what you do. You know those 2 or 3 shepherds that are with you? You say, "Keep my sheep with you because I have to go after the one." See, the church gets all bent out of shape about this parable because they'll say, "Well, if we're all about lost people, what about me?" when we're doing what we should do and have enough shepherds, we will always take care of each other naturally. But there will always be people who have to go after the one that was lost. And by the way, they would not return until they either found the body, a piece of skin, something to prove that they did everything they could. You know what happens to sheep when they get lost? Sheep have a fear factor. Here's the fear factor. When they are overcome with fear, they literally will lie down and they will be so enamored with their fear and overcome that their body, their heart rate, everything will slow down. And if they're not rescued, they will die from fear alone. So they are in great danger when one is missing. They are in great danger when one is missing. So what does this mean for us as a church? When we move from sheep to shepherd and take responsibility, we know people enough to know when they are missing. And we are willing to say, we have enough shepherds among us that some of the other shepherds have to go out and after the ones who are not of this fold. You see, it's both. There's people among us that are hurt, that need fed, that need cared for. We need shepherds. And it's the call of all of us to be shepherds to one another. But we also need shepherds who will go after the one that was lost. Here's what I want to challenge us to do today. I want you to identify your sheep. If you are a follower of Christ, there is someone somewhere who is following you. So how do we do this? By the way, a lot of this material is coming from John 10. It's a good chapter. It's where Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. How do you do this? First of all, you will already know your sheep, and they will know you. So Jesus says that the good shepherd comes to the gate and he calls them by name and they listen because they know his voice. So I think sometimes when we go looking for the one that is lost, we think we have to go knocking on doors to find the lost people. No, there are people who you already know in your life that need a shepherd. So start with people that you know. I've been praying for my neighbor for about a year and a half, and here's what I've realized. I can never be his shepherd at this point in our relationship. You know why? Because I don't know him and he does not know me. I will not give up praying for him, but I recognize that if I'm going to shepherd people, I can't waste a year and a half on people who I can't get to know. But there will be someone somewhere that I can get to know personally. And by the way, I can't know personally 100 people. They say about 3 to 12 people is all in our life that we have the capacity to know intimately. 12 sounds familiar, doesn't it? Jesus knew a thing about being a shepherd. So identify the people who you know and they know you already. Second, you will lead them. That means they trust you enough to follow. See, it's interesting to me that sometimes someone will come to you and they'll ask for advice and it's like they want to be your sheep. So you give them advice, but they do the opposite of what you say. They're not your sheep. Because you cannot lead people who will not listen. There will be people who are hungry enough for what you have that they will listen. And by the way, let me translate this. You know what our job as shepherds is? That's the third thing. To feed them. We have to feed them. What do we feed them with? Feed them with what is feeding you. So take what you hear or read and you have to translate it sometimes and you have to hide it in secular language so that they don't know they're getting food from the good shepherd. But one day they'll learn that they are. So you are translators. You're taking the language of heaven and you're feeding them in an earthly way. See, this is why it works. It works from as soon as you are born until the day that we die. Because some of you are thinking, man, I don't have a position anymore. Yeah, but there's people around you, right? Or are you just like a monk that lives among other monks and you never even talk to each other? I know because I visited a monastery once. It's kind of cool and kind of creepy all at the same time. But if we are any, there are always people who we know, who want to be led, who need to be fed, and finally, who need to be protected. John 10 says, I am the good shepherd, and I will lay down my life for my sheep. You know, as we enter Holy Week, we're reminded that that's what Jesus has done for us. You know, in the 23rd Psalm, he says, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You know why they comforted them? Because the shepherd would get out in front of the sheep and he would take his rod. And whenever there was a wolf trying to attack, he would get the sheep behind him and he would take that rod like a baseball bat and he would swing and hit. And in order for them to get to his sheep, that wolf literally had to kill him. You know, Jesus didn't take a rod with him. You know what he did? He took a cross. He didn't even fight. He said, I'll lay down my life. At the end of that, John chapter 10, he said, there are more sheep that are not of this fold that I have to go get. They will listen to my voice. They will follow me. And we will become one flock with one shepherd. I thought, man, is that not a picture of the church? There are more sheep that are not of our flock. I would tell you, there are sheep who were once part of our flock that have drifted away and have gone missing. And we have to go after. And how do we go after them? Because we go after them knowing them. Love. We go after them to lead them, to feed them, but ultimately to protect them. To say, oh, you're in a battle. You know what? I'm going to stand right beside you and I'm going to fight with you. I'm going to fight with you. You go down, I go down. You drown, I drown. But we'll do it together. Where two or three are in prayer, there he will also be. A strand of two or three cords is not quickly broken, cannot be overcome. I've shared this with you about a year and a half ago. In 2010, there was a census of Warrick County. There were 127 people who claim no faith in any kind of religion. 127,000 people. That time there were 332 congregations. So if all those congregations, if we all reach 10% of the 127,000, our congregation increases by 40 people like that. If we all only reach 5%, everybody would increase by 19 people. If we all reached 1%, every church would increase by 4 people. Most churches are in the decline. So getting 4 people a year would be like novelty. We would be like, wow, we're on a quick way to growth. If one church reached 1%, that's 1,270 people. I don't want to pastor a church of 1,270 people. But I do want 1,270 people to have shepherds. That's a lot of shepherds. If we can only get to know 3 to 12, we need a lot of shepherds. But you know what? If every person in our congregation we could train to become shepherds, and every person had 10 to 12 people, let's say we can do 10, we already have 1,000 people covered. With 100 people, and every person is shepherding 10. And my guess is they're already in our life. Here's what I want to ask you to do today. I'm giving you a homework assignment to identify your sheep. And would you be daring enough to pray for them this week? And daring enough to invite them to church next Sunday on Easter Sunday morning? I'll tell you this. If they say, I kind of have a church I'm a part of, I'm giving you permission. Say, well, if you need someone to go with you, I'll go with you. I hope that you don't keep going to that church. I'll be honest. if you're shepherding them, the kingdom wins. The kingdom wins.